All right, hi, so my name's Andy Bissett.
I'm James Allen.
And this is the Ball Chat Sports Podcast.
There you go, man. Fergie called it. I watched that documentary that was on Netflix, I think, or Prime Video about him. And it was like more about him recovering from his stroke. And I was thinking, I wanted him to just talk shit about people, like Roy Keane style, but he never did. He just downplayed everything. Like everything he did was like, yeah, in that situation, you have to do that. You have to do that. It's like, no, mate, you have to do that. That's why you're a fucking absolute beast at what you do, you mad cunt.
I'm a govern boy. I'm from govern. I'm a govern boy.
He's finally trying to fucking call to with the football advice.
That piece of shit. Conor Flynn.
Conor Flynn.
Too late, man. Too late. We're live on the pod. It made me crease when he was, he said about Solskjaer, he was like, he turned up to United looking like a 14-year-old choir boy. That is exactly what he looks like, isn't it? Solskjaer, to this day, he still looks like a 14-year-old choir boy.
And then he came on in that game, I can't remember against who, and he scored 4 goals off the bench.
He was a super sub. He was like literally the first time I remember is Solskjaer. That was what he was called, a super sub. That's the first real time I'd heard that term. And he used to come on all the time, like pretty much all the time, and score a goal. Basically, Divock Origi, he's the modern day super sub. He always seems to come off the bench and score. Da 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 da. Divock Origi. And on that note, welcome to a new episode of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast. We've got Manchester Derby. It was a good job. We were talking about Ferguson. That's a good little segue to start us off. We've got the Manchester Derby to talk about, although it won't be in good taste for the United fans. And we also have the continuing Everton demise, I'd probably call it. And Frank Lampard's not having a happy time there. We've got UFC roundup of the 272 Chocolatito Masterclass, which Jim's going to go through. And looking ahead to the UFC and the boxing this weekend. So we'll kick off the preamble ramble with the NFL. So news from the NFL, Calvin Ridley has been suspended indefinitely for at least the year 2022 by NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell after it was confirmed he bet $1,500, which is a pretty measly amount when you're on the grand scheme of things, on NFL games over a 5-day period last year. And I'll tell you why I've got a massive, massive problem with this, right? So he's come out and he said on Twitter, he said, I had sort of a few parlays, which are basically accumulators on some NFL. It wasn't on any of his games and it wasn't involving him. So it was just him having a little dabble, having a little tickle on the NFL, like we all like. We all like to have a little tickle, don't we? Anyway, he's had these bets and, you know, they've turned around. Roger Goodell, who's got the power to make these decisions, has turned around and said he's going to be suspended at least for a year and perhaps even more. And the problem I've got with this is, and I'm going to reference the GOAT. He got banned for 4 games, Tom Brady, right? He got banned for four games for deflating the balls so it'd give him an advantage over his opponents. Like a direct cheating, a manipulation of the game, right? He only got 4 game ban. Players in recent history have got 6 game bans for beating up their wives or girlfriends. So, you know, assault on another human being. So I'm sure there's countless other examples, and I didn't really have time to look through, but there could be a myriad of other things that, you know, an NFL player could do, and it would not get up to the sentence that he's been delivered for having a bet on games that he wasn't involved in. So I've got a massive problem with this. And I think the only reason the NFL are concerned with it, because really, at the end of the day, it's affecting their bottom line, isn't it? Like, if they're going to give someone a ban for beating up their girlfriend, then that's really only it's a moral obligation to give them a ban, isn't it? Whereas this is clearly, you know, affecting the ability for, you know, an NFL market to potentially make money. So that's why I think they've done it. What do you think?
I agree with you completely. I've seen here, he did bet on his own team, but it was while he was away on mental health leave. But even then, he's betting for his own team to win. It's not like there's some conspiracy where he's betting for his own team to lose and then he's throwing a game. So I'm with you 100%. I don't quite see the justification for such a harsh penalty here.
I think you're into sketchy territory when you allow sports people to bet, because I understand the rationale that, okay, he's not betting on his own team to lose. But a lot of these players, they're like boys, like in between teams and that, you have friends on other teams. So there's loads of ways you could rig a game and say, look, I'm going to bet on this and you drop points or you just have a shitty game here. I understand why they're not allowed to bet on it, because you can tank a game, you can move the market, you can make loads of money, and then like you're fucking over fans, basically. I also think that it's a harsh punishment as well. I mean, off the top of my head, obviously, I think Bissett's made the point I'd reach for is that because there's money involved and because it brings the NFL into a certain amount of disrepute on the gambling side of things, I think that's why they're making an example of it, when clearly they don't give a fuck about, like, as you say, domestic abuse and fucking assault charges. You know, NFL players are a bunch of wild bastards, and so it's as long as you don't cross the NFL. It's not that the player's done anything wrong in particular. It's that he's crossed that line. So you know what it's like, man. They arbitrarily draw up their own rules, don't they? And then they just punish you accordingly.
I think the argument, you know, to play devil's advocate for the side of the NFL, it'd be that if they allow this to, you know, only have, say, a 2 or 3 game ban, it would set a precedent for future players to, you know, perhaps, you know, take advantage of that. And maybe, you know, because the amount was so small, you know, that's not really going to affect, you know, anything really. But, you know, if they have got inside information, for example, or, you know, they're in allegiance with their teammates to try and match fix, which we've seen happen in basketball. Like, yeah, I think there was a documentary on Netflix, and one was focused on college basketball and players, because they haven't got money. They were contacted by these shady individuals that would be able to manipulate the betting market and say, like, look, you know, score so many, but when you get sort of 6 to 10 points ahead, start missing. Do you know what I mean? And that was happening on a regular. And, you know, these players were getting sort of like 50 grand for doing it per game, which was a hell of a lot of money. You know what I mean? To a sort of 18, 19 year old player who doesn't really get paid, or doesn't get paid at all by college basketball teams, or, you know, I don't think the college football teams, as much adoration they get, they don't actually get any financial gain. So, you know, you can understand why there would be an avenue that the NFL are worried that players will go down in terms of like sort of match fixing and stuff. So I think that's probably why they've sort of, you know, they've, what's the term with the book called? Handed the book to him. Is that right? Yeah, I guess.
Or threw the book at him. But yeah, listen, that was one of the cases that people made for before college athletes received financial rewards for their sport. I mean, I think it's changed now, hasn't it? They did change the rule. I think we covered that on the pod like last year or something. So it's removed that incentive. I can't believe college sports was like a free game for as long as it was. This mental 100,000 fans in the fucking stadium, shirt signs, likenesses. The colleges are making fucking hundreds of millions of dollars. And then, no, we can't give any to the players. That would be immoral. Yeah. All right. Sound.
There was a college basketball game, and this geezer had been in charge for like donkey's years. That happens quite a lot. Like, college coaches stay in their positions for ages in both like basketball and football, I've noticed. And it was this geezer's last home game, and like tickets were going for like 20 grand or something for like his last game. It's fucking balmy, man. Like, honestly, Yanks are absolutely mad for it, man. Just mad for spending money, I find. Like, I was in the gym the other day, and some geezer gave the geezer like $40 just as a little tip. The young lad that was working there, he was just like looking up at him like, are you sure? Do you know what I mean? Like, give him like $40. It's like, you wouldn't see that anywhere else, would you?
That was probably a down payment for a blowjob in the car park, man.
100, man. 100. All right, let's move on to the Manchester derby. Sorry, Man United fans, it's not going to be pretty hearing. But we'll have a little overview of the game in general. Then we'll sort of like we'll talk about sort of where United are, and you know, how far are they off the Ferguson era? You know, someone who was talking about at the start of the episode. So basically, Grealish got a start ahead of Raheem Sterling, which I was pretty surprised with, because I don't think he's been, you know, he hasn't quite matched his price tag since he's come to Man City. And I don't think he's really been in Pep's good books, especially obviously him and Foden had that little they'd fallen out with Guardiola because whatever they were doing, out partying or whatever. But they've both managed to get themselves back in the team. United started without a recognised striker, much like a lot of the top teams are doing now, to be fair. Bruno Fernandes looked like he was the furthest man forward in Ronaldo's absence, but would often drop back into those spaces between defence and midfield. You know, a lot like Harry Kane's been doing. I think he's been doing that really well over the last few games. Obviously, Man City utilised that position with Gundogan. And, you know, since Sergio Aguero's gone and they've not got a sort of natural out-and-out striker, you've seen a lot of teams do this, and I think it's working really, really well. I think that's the way the game's evolving. Do you know what I mean? I think there's a lot of players that are attacking midfielders, but they play in that position and they play in that false nine position. I think Fernando Torres did it in the Euros. I think he's the first time I remember doing it, like 2012, something like that, when Spain were going for that period of dominance. Even Kevin De Bruyne has played there. So early lead for Man City. Obviously, it was good work on the left-hand side between Grealish and Bernardo Silva. And the ball was weighted perfectly for an onrushing Kevin De Bruyne. And obviously, United got back into it pretty well. You know, Jadon Sancho got on the score sheet. I think he's been better over the last few games. Do you think he's sort of, Jim, do you think he's coming into his own now, Jadon Sancho? He's starting to fill up to that potential.
Obviously, Kem highly touted from Borussia Dortmund. Barely featured in the Euros. I mean, I didn't really know what to expect from him. I've seen him flourish a little bit here and there. I think he scored like a banger towards the beginning of the season. This is the first, I don't know what his goal scoring record is like this season, but that was the first time I'd heard his name in a big game like this. So I honestly couldn't tell you what kind of an impact he's had this year. I don't remember there being that much crazy hype about him either when he arrived. I mean, you might correct me if I'm wrong on that, but it was kind of like, oh, this is a good signing. If not, there was more hype surrounding Jude Bellingham, really, I thought. So, yeah, I couldn't really say. But I'll tell you this, that was a nice finish. That was a really, really nice finish and a rare high point in the game for Man United. So you got to give him credit on that level.
Yeah, one of very few highlights. But that first half, you know, obviously they conceded the second. Very, very poor and strange defending from Harry Maguire, who sort of like dummied it as it came off. I think Edison, or it was deflected away, or it was off the post or something. But he dummied it, and then there was a block, and then Kevin De Bruyne was there on point to score. No one picked him up, by the way. If you watch back that play, there's at least three players that sort of knew where he was, and nobody tracked him, which is another problem that Man United are going to find themselves in. Second half, that was where the real damage was done, and I think that's where a lot of the criticism has sort of like spurned from. I think, you know, City were clearly trying to attack that right-hand side of United, even in the sort of first half, but even second half, first 25 minutes, 60% of their attacks were focused there. I think Pep was probably targeting the inexperience of Anthony Elanga and the defensive incapabilities of Aaron Wan-Bissaka. But, you know, I think second half really, it's not really about getting beat by the better team. I think that happens to every team. Do you know what I mean? It's happened to Man United more often than not when it comes to Liverpool and Manchester City over the last few years. But I think it was the effort levels that really spoke volumes. The last 25 minutes, there was really a lack of effort. I think if I remember seeing the graphic, it was something, there was a period of 10 minutes in the second half where Man City had 92% possession. Is that right? So it's just, you know, it's outrageous, really. It's not good enough.
Yeah, I've seen McTominay come out post-game saying, like, pretty much raging that people were questioning their effort levels, really. What did you say? Second half, it looked like party time for City, didn't it, really? Who was your man who tried that scissor kick from the edge of the box just because? That was nearly a real goal of the season contender. You could tell they were adventurous. They were feeling the dominance that they were experiencing at that time. And we were saying in the group, weren't we, that like how many of United's players would even make the City bench, let alone their starting 11? So that got me wondering. Ralph Rangnick has had a lot of criticism after this. And I heard Gary Neville and the lads saying, like, he's only coming into the end of the year. They're getting other managers, blah, blah, blah. I'm sure he came in on like a two-season contract. And now all of a sudden they're talking, oh, it's only ever been to the end of the season. He's not had that many years recently in active management. So is this a case of just inferior personnel on Man United's part against Man City? Is it a case of inferior tactics, or is it just both and they're completely outmatched in their Northeast derby or Northwest derby? Sorry.
Yeah, it was João Cancelo, the one that their left back that nearly scored that scissor kick. And I think for me, it was like Man City's left backs doing scissor kicks, nearly scoring. Like that really shows the golfing quality between them and United. And City's bench. So, you know, Raheem Sterling, and this sort of like leads into whether they've got inferior players or inferior tactics. Raheem Sterling on the bench, he gets in over like Elanga, well, anywhere in that midfield, Man United midfield. Gundogan gets anywhere in that midfield, over McTominay, over Fred, over probably Paul Pogba. Gabriel Jesus, you probably put him in Bruno Fernandes' position and then you drop him into midfield. Alexander Zinchenko, 100%. I don't think Wan-Bissaka, I don't think Alex Telles, and I don't think Diogo Dalo. I don't think they're good enough in terms of the fullbacks. I don't think Man United have had decent fullbacks for a few years now. Fernandinho, I mean, come on. You're talking Fred and McTominay, and they've got Fernandinho on the bench. It's just like...
You like Fred, don't you? You think he's all right? I think world-class guy. You've always said that in the pod. I'm pretty sure.
I'm sure he called him a nonce last time.
Nah, that was me playing Soz.
It's good you mentioned the golfing quality in this derby, because I was reading a New York Times article about this very match. And the whole point of the article is that this isn't how derbies are supposed to be. They're supposed to be like febrile and full of anger and fury. And the writer said it's difficult to escape the sense that over the years, much of that fury has dissipated in the Manchester derby. There's just too big of a gulf now. And it's like Man City don't even really need to try anymore.
And that's how it used to be the other way around. You know, I remember all the United players used to say that Man City is a derby game, but it's not our derby game. Our derby game is Liverpool, because that's where the combative atmosphere was, where they were most evenly matched. And that was only like, if you go back to the early 2000s, you're talking like they're playing lads like Sean Gota and that. These are fucking relegation battlers year in, year out. It's outrageous the turnaround that club's had, man. I tell you what, Newcastle fans, the next 10 years are going to be so good for them, man. It's going to be so good.
Yeah, and I think Ranić, I think he was a sort of, a caretaker manager. I don't think he was ever, you know, he was never expected to do the job full time. Obviously, if he was really successful and he gets him to the top four, I don't think he will now. But if he, you know, did well and he got him to the top four, potentially he would have taken position on. It's looking like the Ajax manager.
This as well, a quick question for you. They were talking in the studio, in the Sky Sports studio after the game, and they were adamant that, what's your man's name from Ajax again? Ten Hag and Mauricio Pochettino were the lead candidates for the job. And I was thinking to myself, didn't PSG drop points in the league all the time against bog standard opposition? And look how many superstars he's got there, man. I don't understand the allure of Pochettino when he's been just as patchy as the managers that have had through the door at United over the past few years. Like, are they just grasping for straws? Who do you think is the better option out of them two?
Pochettino's a proven Premier League manager, so he did a really good job at Tottenham. I think it may be his success that he had with a lot of the youth players there, or the younger players. Obviously, Harry Kane was a lot younger when Pochettino was there. You got Dele Alli, I think, what was really good under his tenure. So you got a good few young players that he sort of developed, and I think if he can instill that within United, I think he could be a good appointment. But once again, you know, how many times do we sort of, you know, it's quite easy to blame the manager, isn't it? And consistently, you know, always point the fingers at the coach. But I think you have to point the fingers at the recruitment level or the standard of recruitment at United over the past few years, maybe the last sort of eight seasons. It just hasn't really been good enough. And I think Harry Maguire is catching a lot of stick. People are saying pound for pound, worst Man United signing ever, which is... bold statement.
That is some statement, isn't it, man?
So,
I mean, because it's considering the price tag, though, isn't it, as well? What is it,
of course it is. Of course it is. I'd throw Fred into that ring as well, man. 55 million for him. But there's been, you know, a lot of poor signings over the last sort of, you know, definitely over the last three or four seasons. I don't think they've recruited well at all. So I think that the book's got to fall at them. You know what I mean? You can blame the manager all you want, man. But sometimes if you haven't got the resources to be able to compete with Man City and Liverpool, which they haven't, they're miles off. And this goes into our sort of next topic, which is how far are they off winning a Premier League title?
Well, just before we go into it, who is in charge of the recruitment, if not the manager?
Yeah, like if your manager, like Fergie and his inner circle, I suppose, were almost definitely in charge of recruiting players back in the day. But who does it now? Is it like a director of football? Is it the lead scout? Or is it fucking... Do you know what I mean? Like who...
Surely the manager's got to have that executive decision, you'd think.
I think it's like not that anymore at top clubs, you know. I think there's a level like between the chairman and the manager that kind of liaises and sorts it out. Like I feel like, correct me if I'm wrong, Bissett, but there's the coaching staff and the manager kind of recommend players they want. And then on a business level, the chairman might want a player for like shirt fees, or whatever. Do you know what I mean? So I think there's a lot of that shit going on. Like who would have thought Paul Pogba would be a poor signing for United? He's been fucking shocking, man. Do you know what I mean? And he'd be one of those guys where the name's on the shirt, people are excited about it. Recruitment probably got it right at the time before he came to the club. He was killing it. But the atmosphere and the environment at the club has brought down his levels, or he's decided to drop his levels because he's not getting a certain thing out of the club in probably an uninspiring environment. Managers in and out the door every couple of years. Like, his agent's one of those scumbags who's constantly threatening for him to like leave and all that kind of stuff. Like, it's just not the right ingredients to be or to reach your potential as a top level footballer, is it?
Yeah, and Paul Pogba is a good example of when you're talking about the difference between bringing in players for their their potential performances on the pitch and to extend the caliber of the squad. Versus the opportunity to make financial gains in terms of shirt sales and sort of sponsorship opportunities, because I think Man United definitely made their money back on Pogba, you know, commercially. But has he improved the squad? Not at all. And he's probably actually been detriment to the squad, because I don't think his character works very well when you haven't got a lot of sort of strong characters in the dressing room. And obviously Ronaldo coming in once again, Ronaldo's kind of like a bit of both, because he's one of the best footballers we've ever seen play the game. So he does a bit of the both. You know what I mean? He's going to bring you that sort of like commercial viability, but he's also going to raise performances on the pitch and be a figure in the dressing room. But, you know, is Cristiano Ronaldo a leader? Would you say he's somebody that's going to grab a team that's in the doldrums, grab them by the scruff of the neck, and like sort of like bring them into prominence? I'm not quite sure. I think he needs other characters around the dressing room to be, and him be sort of like a big cog, but he needs other cogs around him.
Yeah, I seen a clip on YouTube last week, I think, that speaks directly to this point. It was about when Ronaldo was at Juve, and obviously he didn't achieve the heights that he wished that the club wanted him to. They wanted Champions League, didn't they, when he went there? I think they ended up finishing fourth one season, getting knocked out by Real Madrid in the second round or the quarterfinals or something. And it must have been for one of those like Amazon Prime documentaries, because it had the footage from inside the changing room. And Ronaldo's coming in fuming. He's like, we played like shit. He's like, you've got to put your life on the line. He's like, we played like shit the whole time. And the way he was going on, it was like he was bollocking everyone. And then everyone was like kind of looking and no one wanted to say anything. Then Cuadrado stepped up and he was like, look, man, like we're trying our best. You know what I mean? You're part of this team as well. People are looking to you for examples. You're standing there moaning. And Ronaldo went, listen, I include myself in this. We all played like shit. We should demand more of ourselves. And that illustrated to me that he probably goes off on one in the dressing room because he demands so much from himself, but there are players around him who aren't on his level. So that could breed frustration. It could breed dissent. It could breed a little bit of resentment from his teammates if he's so hard on them. And as you say, if there aren't bigger or slightly smaller cogs around him to ameliorate his presence and to kind of put an arm... Look, it's like man management inside the dressing room, isn't it? If you haven't got other personalities that are a bit softer but are also on his level technically, it can be a bit like just getting shouted at all the time. It's like when former players become managers, like we're seeing with Lampard at the minute. It must be so frustrating for them to see fucking average players when they've been setting records their whole careers. It's not an easy balance to strike dynamic-wise in the changing room.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I also read something. I think his name's Hannibal Mejbri. He was on the bench for the Man City game. He's a youth player. I think he's French, Turkish descent or something like that. And he was on the bench, and I was reading an article involving him saying that he was like scared to talk to Ronaldo. And that doesn't strike me as being a positive, a positive facet to the environment that's at United, if that's been set there. So I think you're probably right. I think he needs players that are going to question him and sort of almost direct his frustration and direct his sort of, his criticism of the team and, you know, sort of give some clarity to the rest of the team. So maybe he does that. Man United obviously need other players that are in the dressing room that are going to sort of like, you know, rein him in a little bit. Because obviously, you know, he is egotistical. You can't be as good as he is and have the career that he's had without having a massive ego. So I just think maybe he needs sort of like, you know, molding into the dressing room a little bit more with another couple of players that have a lot of experience as well. Because at the moment, it just doesn't seem like there's many characters or many leaders in the Man United dressing room, man.
If let's assume that he is like this in the dressing room on the regular, he's screaming at everyone. He's acting like he is the leader. Is there anyone in that dressing room who you think could stand up to him and rein him in?
Well, fucking Harry Maguire's meant to be the captain. He didn't even come out in the post-match and talk to the cameras. It was left up to Scott McTominay. And like, he didn't have a good game. I don't think he's definitely not Man United quality. But, you know, I've got a massive, massive respect for him coming out and saying what he said, because he defended everybody in that dressing room when Harry Maguire, the captain, couldn't even step up and do it. And Harry Maguire has been shocking. He's been shocking all season, man. He has not been good enough, honestly. And I don't think he's good enough as a centre-back. And, you know, I very, very rarely agree with Paul Merson. But what Paul Merson said was that when Harry Maguire was at Leicester, he would play with another sort of eight players in front of him, innit? And they would play defensive football and hit players on the counter-attack. So him, that sort of catered to his physical attributes, innit? Because he's big, he's strong, you know, he can head the ball away. You know, he's good in sort of like one-on-one situations where the spaces are quite confined and quite tight, and he can make it nice and compact. But when you go to Man United and they're looking to high press and they're looking to get into people's faces, and you've got four or five players that perhaps are not very good at doing that, because I don't think Cristiano Ronaldo has historically been good at that. And I don't think Bruno Fernandes is good enough, and Pogba's not good enough. So you haven't really got players that are well adapted to a high press. When they get four or five of them get bypassed, and now you've got five Manchester City players who are the best in the world at attacking in the final third, bearing down on you, and you're having to use your pace, you're having to use your time and your anticipation. All skills that he didn't really have to use at Leicester because they used to sit behind the ball. Now he's becoming undone, man. And I think that's really sort of exacerbating the issues of Manchester United because, I think people are just targeting him. And, he's meant to be the captain. He's meant to be the £80 million player, England's saviour, big slab Eddie Maguire. It's just, and it's baffling. And I don't think, I worry a little bit for England as well.
Oh, I knew it was coming around. We still believe. I think you've absolutely nailed that. He's flourished in one system and now he's suffering in another because, you know, the Old Trafford pitch is massive. They try to play attacking football and you're going to get caught out at certain times. And there are very few teams in Europe that could stand up to Man City in when the circumstances are like that. So it's no surprise that they got absolutely torn to shreds. But, you know, the whole team's culpable at the end of the day. I know he's the captain, but, you know, it was an organisational issue as well as a determination issue. But to answer your initial question, you've got to say that United are less likely to finish in the top four than Arsenal at the minute. Come on, man. Arsenal are a point. They're a point in front of United and they got three games in hand, mate. When the fuck has this happened recently? And look at the form book as well. Last five games, Arsenal have won four, drawn one. United lost that last game, drawn two, won two. Mate, things are looking up. I mean, they might still fuck it up, but Arsenal recently have been on a tear. And even if I wasn't an Arsenal fan, I'd be backing them to finish above United this season, man. It's just going that way. It's going that way.
They'd be massive favourites, man. And I think that the goals that Arsenal scored against Watford were sensational. I'm talking all three of them were like pure goals you'd be proud of on FIFA, man. The way they moved the ball, the finishes, everything about it, man. Like Martinelli is looking like a player. We've been saying this for a few months now. One of the few things that we have actually got right. He's looking like a great player. Saka's looking sensational. Odegaard, like what a signing he could be. 35 million and he's still only 23. Like if he stays there for another 6 years and keeps on playing the way he's playing, that's going to be an unbelievable signing. Lacazette's like, you know, filling the hole that Aubameyang left. And now he hasn't, obviously Arteta hasn't got to deal with all that, all the shit that was going down with him. Honestly, man, like Arsenal, they're really, really in the ascendancy, man.
It's coming good, man. And I'm happy because, like, it's a young team as well. Obviously, defensive issues. Watford managed to score two in that game. Probably not what you want to be doing. But as you say, those were, like, old school Arsenal goals, weren't they, man? Like, especially, I think it was the first one where Odegaard dropped that little back heel around the corner. And then they're just fucking zooming towards the goal. And, like, Watford didn't know what the fuck was going on. So, if they can get a couple of nice signings in the summer, hopefully like defensive mid, centre-back or two or three, you know, just to shore up that area. You know, you never know what's going to happen. Obviously, light years away from Liverpool or City and probably Chelsea. But, you know, top four, this is as good as you can ask for from Arsenal, especially given the form in recent seasons.
I don't know, man. If they finish the season strongly, I think they, you know, we could be talking and they make maybe another really good signing in central midfield, perhaps another centre-back. I think we could be talking, you know, Arsenal and Chelsea in the same breath in a year's time. You never know. Obviously, it's probably going to turn out to be another terrible take.
Hot take from Bissett.
But we'll move over to another club in North London that was involved in a game with Everton, who, you know, I just think I'm worried for Lampard already. I think he's only, what, 5 or 6 games in. I think out of the five or six Premier League games he's been in charge, have they won what two? Is it two out and two lost four? Is it one, two, lost four? But it's the manner of their defeats, which is very, very worrying. And I think it's going to be a serious battle for Everton to stay in the Premier League this season. They're only a point outside the relegation zone. They have got a game in hand over Burnley. But we spoke about Burnley's ability and their experience in these battles. And Everton, they have literally zero experience. Like they are the team that have never been relegated from the Premier League. Obviously, with the other big ones, it was sort of like Aston Villa and Everton, which were the mid-table teams that have never been relegated. But obviously, Villa got relegated a few seasons ago. But Everton's the only team outside of those, the big boys that haven't. And what did you make of this? Did you see the highlights of this, lads?
Yeah, the just to speak to Everton's form and just how worrying a time it is at Goodison Park. The last five, they've only won one and lost the other four. So they should be worried and you should be worried about Lampard's fate. I watched the highlights and it looked like Everton got absolutely rinsed by Tottenham. Harry Kane, bearing in mind the amount of shit we've sent his way over the last year, he reached a major scoring milestone and passed Thierry Henry's Premier League scoring record. And say what you want about him and how he chooses to play his game and all the rest of it, his dips in form and all that. But that's actually a next level achievement. And now he's closing in on Frank Lampard's record. And like, imagine if you broke it during that game, like that'd be kilos of salt in the wound, man. I watched Lampard's post-match interview. He looked absolutely dejected, understandable after a 5-0 hammering. But he did seem to have a realistic view of the remaining 13 league games and the form of the teams around Everton, which he seemed to take encouragement from. He also made a tantalising little admission that the problems he inherited in the job are now becoming clearer to him each day. And I've been wondering what was on his mind when he said that. I did see a headline as well that some Everton fans want Steve Bruce to take over. However true that is after a handful of games in charge, I couldn't say. But those people who are speculating or wishing the end for Lampard are doing so prematurely for me. If you inherit that situation and that poor of a team and they're already on the slide and you haven't got the opportunity to bring in new personnel, you're on for a losing battle. Lampard was an immense player. I still think he's got a lot to prove as a Premier League level manager. I know he did good work at Derby. I think he did half decent at Chelsea. It just wasn't up to the level that they've come to expect over the last few years. I think now, in eagerness to get back into active management, I think he's taken on a very, very tall task indeed. So I hope they don't go down. But at the end of the day, like, it's a results-based sport, isn't it? So if you can't get the job done, it's like tough titties, isn't it, kid? It's like, what can you do?
I've just got a bit of a problem with him saying that he's inherited a difficult job. 9 times out of 10, when you come in as a new manager, that's how it's going to be. So I can't really give him any sympathy on that one. Now,
you know what? That's what he said, though. He said, I knew the job when I came in. I know what I've got to do. He's like, we're still positive, like, not stupid positivity, but we're still positive. Like, we've had good performances in big games. He said, like, we made it tough for City when we played them. I don't know how true that is. But he seemed to be like, have a pragmatic approach and kind of positive, even though things were going shit. And I feel like he was absolutely raging. And I would be interested to see if he makes major alterations to his squad and to his formations, to his tactics and all that over the coming 13 games, because he's going to have to. This can't carry on, or they'll be like chilling with Norwich in the Championship next year.
Yeah, and I don't understand. You have to put the blame at his tactics. You know, you can blame the sort of squad he's inherited, you know, all you want, but there are some good players in that squad. Perhaps they're not fitting. You know, they're not gelling. There's no fluidity, really. It looked to me, I couldn't really understand, you know, I couldn't understand his tactics. I couldn't really understand what he was trying to achieve because, you know, as a coach, you'd expect him to go in and look at the previous games, look at who Tottenham have played recently. Wolves went there. I think they won 1-0, no, 2-0. Wolves went when they're 2-0, they played defensive football, hit him on the counter-attack. And, you know, as you talk about pragmatism, as you just were, Jim, like that's a sensible thing to do when you're a team that are in the rut. You know, you're going through, you know, a bad run of form. There's poor performances. Players' morale is low. You need to get a little bit of confidence back. What do? You go back to basics, man. This is what all the managers have done in the Premier League. This is how they get teams to survive. And this is either the case that, you know, everyone around evolved with the coaching staff at Everton is deluded, you know, and they're under the impression that they're not in that position. They have got enough quality to get out of it. Or they're just simply not adhering to simple sort of like tactical instructions, the players that is. But, you know, they've gone out of Tottenham and they've tried to hard press him. It looked good for the first 10 minutes. And then, you know, they had their own goal, Michael Keane, who your mate Nick, who said he was the worst at, he was the worst player out of the two. And that's coming good. That's looking like a pretty good prediction in the minute because he's not looking good over the past sort of 18 months, Michael Keane. I don't think he's going to get into the England team in the winter either. They had Mason Holgate as a centre-back. Seamus Coleman, to me, looked like he was part of a back three initially, but then at halftime they were talking about a back four. You know, and then you got Anthony Gordon on the right-hand side? Jonjo Kenny on the left? To me, they're Championship players. I don't think they're good enough really to be in the Premier League.
That's what Carragher was saying, man. That's what Jamie Carragher was saying. He's like, half of these lads do not belong in the Premier League. He's like, these are terrible. He said they're worse than the Everton teams from the early 90s, man. And they were shocking.
you know, so I don't really understand. They had that new lad, Mykolenko, the Ukrainian lad. He's a left back. I don't know why he didn't start and put Seamus Coleman at right back and then play Holgate and Keane in the middle. But Mason Holgate, like, he looked all over the shop, man. Like, really, really bad. Like, I just didn't look like he had, you know, he wasn't keeping up with the pace of the Premier League. And when you got players like Harry Kane dropping in deep to collect the ball and then spinning in behind, you've got players like Hyun Min Son and Kulusevski, who had a great game very, very impressive yet again. You know, they were just, and it could have been 8 or 9 quite easily. And we say that sometimes when there's a big score, but really they should have scored at least another 3. So, like, extremely worrying for Everton. They just need to get back to basics, man, and just play like a 4-5-1. Just get a point. Just really, just get a 0-0 draw, man. Like, play 4 at the back, 5 across midfield, 3 in the middle. I don't know why that Alan does. I didn't see anything good defensively from him. Decore was good at Watford, good box-to-box midfielder, but he didn't. He looked poor. Donny van der Beek, we spoke about him a lot over the last sort of 4 months at United, but I don't know if he's good enough either. I don't know if he's a Premier League player. I've seen him quite a few times now, and it's not been good.
That's mad, you know, considering how good he was in that Ajax team that knocked Real Madrid out of the Champions League, only to go on and get knocked out by Tottenham by that Lucas Moura goal, last ditch. He looked amazing in that team. What the fuck has happened, man? It's the United curse, isn't it, man? You go there, post-Fergie, you just turn into a shit player, and now his confidence is probably shot. I don't know, man. I didn't, like, watch the full game, so I couldn't comment properly, but I just can't believe that that's the same guy, really. It speaks volumes, doesn't it?
Same with Dele Alli as well. He looks like he's picking up a paycheck, man. Like, he really doesn't look like he's come there to actually try and reinvigorate his career. It's just his whole attitude when he comes on the pitch and the way he's sort of like sulking around the pitch. It feels like he feels sorry for himself. I really don't know what's going on with him either.
Just want to go back to something you mentioned a sec ago. Going back to basics, are you talking that they need to get more defensive and just steal little draws and things like that? What's that mean?
Going absolutely back to basics? Yeah. Go back to basics. Play 4-4-2. Play a system that all the players can immediately adjust to and understand. Don't try and play a system that perhaps some players have only played, I don't know, 10 games in their career. Like, get a system which is 4-4-2. That's the most simple system for players really to play. Some will say maybe it's like a 4-2-3-1. That's probably become a bit more the modern sort of, like, get back to basics is the 4-2-3-1. All teams can play that. And then just, as you say, yeah, play defensive football. Get players behind the ball. Say, right, let's do a mid-block. Let's say when the opposition back four have got the ball, right, we get to halfway and we just make it nice and compact around the midfield. Let's not push on too much and try and high-press them, because if we get bypassed, we're going to be sort of like, you know, they're going to start to create overloads in wide positions and then they're going to exploit us in the middle. So let's just sit off. Play defensive, compact. When we win the ball, let's just try and hit him quick on the counter-attack. Like, it's a simple tactic that a lot of managers that come into Premier League teams when they're really, really struggling have used, like, for, I don't know, at least the last decade. You know, managers like Sam Allardyce, managers like, what's his name, Tony Pulis. Like, you know, they're not glamorous managers, but Everton fans don't want anything glamorous right now. They want a manager to come in and start getting results quickly with the team they've got, and they can't make any more signings now. So they're not going to improve, you know, they're not going to improve the squad. So they need to just start getting performances. So be pragmatic, be defensive, and just try and be a horrible team to play against. Start there, and then you can start to flourish. But at the moment, they're in a relegation battle. They need to start fucking doing. And I don't know if Lampard's that man. I don't know if he's that guy.
It's funny how the aspirational approach to the high press is really fucking some teams up, isn't it? Like, you have to have a well-drilled team with players that are fit as fuck, following your instructions to the detail, and your tactics have to be spot on to make that work. There's a lot of ingredients to making the high press work. It's obviously like a very delicate balance, and even the top teams get caught out by doing it, man. Do you know what I mean? So I don't know why you would want to overcomplicate your approach, like you say. But then again, you've got long-time professionals who might not be on, like, oh, just sitting back and doing some basic shit. They might think, oh, we're better than this. Man's like Donny van der Beek, who grew up in Ajax, like, playing that kind of football. Dele Alli, who was lauded as, like, England's next generational talent. They might be thinking, I'm better than this. What? I'm not fucking sitting back and just doing that basic shit. I want some highlights kind of thing. I think there's an element of that to it as well, you know.
So there's a systematic issue with it then, because the director of football, and as we were speaking about recruitment teams, nowadays, I think football's going the direction of American sports, where you have a general manager makes all the decisions, and then the sort of coach just has a little bit of, right, there's my shortlist of players that I want. Oh, there's 10 midfielders that I'd like. in order of sort of importance. And then the general manager will go and see who he can get. So I think that's where we're at in terms of recruitment. So whoever, I can't name who the director of football at Everton is at the minute. I know the last guy got sacked. I don't know who's in that position at the moment. But they've gone out there and they've brought in Dele Alli and Donny van de Beek. All right, if those two players, which for me, if I was going to set up a team that wanted to play defensively in a relegation battle, I wouldn't bring in those two players, would you? So they obviously haven't fought, or they've had the conversation with Frank Lampard, and Frank Lampard's been like, "Yeah, I want to play this expansive football. You know, I want to press teams high. I want to win the ball. I want to build out from the back. I want 25 passes before I have a shot." It fucking sounds great. Like, you know, that's okay. I imagine I want my U9s to play like that. I want us to have 25 passes before we have a shot on goal. Do you know what I mean? I want us to high press as a team, hunt in packs, make sure there's no space, you know, throttle the team. But I'm telling you, it just doesn't work like that. When you've got a team that keep the ball better than you do, you come unstuck. So they've brought in those two players, right, to play a system that they don't necessarily need to play right now. Do you know what I mean? So they're poor signings, in my opinion, based on the philosophy that Lampard, you know, I don't know. He's obviously not had any sort of like discussion with that. So I think there's fundamental systematic issues within that club.
It sounds like it's a bit of an ego issue. I'm part of these top players are bringing in, and part of Lampard too. But have you ever seen him in his managing career play a basic style yet?
Derby, it's tough to say. I'd say probably no, because you know he's had the players comparatively. Derby were a decent team when he was there. He did well with them, but they had some good players. If I remember correctly, when he was there, obviously Chelsea, he had an array of talent to work with. He's coming to Everton where he hasn't got the talent. So this is his first time being in a club comparatively that haven't got the talent. And it's a different situation, man. It's a different objective with this team. And I think, you know, is he the right man for the job? It could be yet another poor appointment by Farhad Moshiri. And he's got like a litany of terrible appointments so far. Do you know what I mean? And this one's not looking like it's going to be a good one. Honestly, I really, really worry for Everton. I really think they're going to be, you know, in the last couple of games, we're going to be talking about them getting relegated, which is really, really sad because they're a club steeped in history. We've never really, associated them with getting relegated. So
I think they're one of only six teams to never been relegated. Is that right?
Yeah. Arsenal, Manchester United, Man City, Chelsea, Tottenham, Everton, yeah. And it was Villa. I think there was seven, and obviously they were the last ones to get relegated. So, yeah, it's times are a-changing. But Jim, have you got some review of the Champions League games? I actually didn't watch anything of the Champions League game yesterday, but I did see the results.
Yeah, I just watched the highlights myself. So Bayern Munich overturned a score draw result from the first fixture of their tie against RB Salzburg. Lewandowski, as Thomas Muller calls him, scored a 22-minute hat-trick to take his tally past 40 for the seventh consecutive season. That's ridiculous. Suck it, Gerd Muller. Sané, Gnabry and Thomas Muller with a brace did the rest of the damage. Though Salzburg's 18-year-old Merit Kjaergaard grabbed a nice consolation goal for Salzburg. That ended 8-2 on aggregate. Bayern cruise through to the next round. Liverpool suffered, I'd say, an unexpected defeat at the hands of Inter at home. Martinez with a top corner belter after a poor Matic pass to earn the away win, though Liverpool still win the tie after scoring two goals away from home. Alexis Sanchez with two yellow cards as well to leave his side with 10 men for the last half an hour. There were a lot of close calls for Liverpool, to be honest. Matic and Salah both hit the woodwork, but they'll be disappointed they didn't score at home. You know, we're used to seeing that quality, that kind of adventurous play from Liverpool. Trent was on fire. I mean, is there a better deliverer of the ball in world football than Trent Alexander-Arnold? He makes threats out of every dead ball situation. Anytime he's got space, he's looking to release, man. Absolutely incredible. And I'm glad, man, because he got to win the Champions League as a young man. You're not hearing the usual Real Madrid, Barcelona chat because they're not in the position that they once were to hunt these basic, to use the Americanism, these franchise players I'm glad to see him stay at Liverpool and to carry on reaching and surpassing his potential. But I think Liverpool got away with one here a little bit, saying that they did have a lot of chances, but it's not often you don't see him score at home, especially in the Champions League. So they'll be happy to go through regardless. Well done to Inter. And I actually forgot that Alexis Sanchez was there. He looks about 55 years old now. He got the Man United curse as well, didn't he, man? He's got grey hair and everything.
Yeah, and I think I'd say Trent's the best right back in the world, man. I challenge anybody to deliver a case to me as to who is a better right back than him at the moment.
I'll fight any man who presents a charge against fucking Trent Alexander-Arnold. Yeah, he was ridiculous, man. And he's such a unit as well. He's like 6'2 or something. Big, athletic, fast, responsive, not too proud to clear the ball. He's not looking for silly passes when the ball's bouncing in the box. Pragmatic, but creative. Yeah, man. Fucking sick. I enjoyed just watching the little glimpses of him in that game, as I have.
And Kylian Mbappe's just scored for PSG against Real Madrid. The Mbaps. 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 But should we do the... should we smash out the five things and then do the combat sports?
Yeah, for sure, man. Okay, so number one on the top five things, you might have missed this last week, Josh Taylor's controversial undisputed title win against Jack Catterall from, I think it was 2 weeks ago now, getting on 10 days. It's been brought to the attention of the police by various political figures in the UK. That's a nice way to glide over it, isn't it? And look, they're basically investigating corruption. The head of the British Boxing Border Control, Robert Smith, has been made to comment on this. And usually he's the type of guy who dismisses outrage against bad decisions as, oh, it's just a bunch of pissheads on Twitter having 12 cans on a Saturday night. And he's been able to defend his organization and his personnel on that basis for a long time. And I'm glad it's being investigated by police, because the outright denial of known boxing figures like Steve Bunce, like even people who, look, I like Steve Bunce. I think he's a fucking idiot. I think he's a good boxing writer. I think he talks absolute nonsense. Carl Frampton, massive fan, great fighter, multiple weight world champion, pragmatic guy. And there are countless others who just say there's no corruption in boxing. Oh, there's no brown envelopes. There's no backhanders. It's like, read a fucking book, man. Like, it's the most corrupt sport, one of the most corrupt sports in the world. The corruption is so out there and in front that things that would be considered incredibly corrupt in other sports are just accepted as part of this niche boxing environment. So you can go from the rankings, you can go from weight-making stipulations, you can go from PED fucking punishments from certain fighters to others. The game is fucking rigged 90% of the time, and it was fucking rigged with Catterall versus Taylor, man. I'm so glad it's being referred to the police. I'm not sure how this investigation is going to carry out, whether it goes to like a criminal investigation or whether they're just going to hold a few interviews or whatever. But I'm glad it's receiving this amount of attention. I know Josh Taylor has said he'll agree to fight Catterall at a catch weight, which means, like, you know, Catterall's still not going to get his opportunity to fight for the undisputed title.
No justice, is it?
Like, no, not at all. I mean, it will be a good commercial venture. He'll get the payday. And if he fights like that again, he'll beat Josh Taylor. But I said it the other week, I think that was the perfect night for him. And it was fucking ruined by incompetent judges. Incompetent is giving him the benefit of the doubt, because I think there was something else going on there, man. And I really don't trust this narrative that, oh, there's no backhanders. There's no outright corruption. There's no bribery. Look, corruption and bribery take a lot of different forms. You don't have to take someone to a fucking hotel and like get them a prosy and give them a suitcase full of cash. A lot of the times it's more insidious than that, you know, paid vacations and shit and preferential treatment and all this other kind of stuff that just happens and no one gives a fuck about. So I'm happy it's being referred. I'm not sure how far it's going to go, but this is a good step in the right direction.
Do you think this could potentially open like a fucking massive can of worms though?
Well, it depends. Like, I don't know the nature of the investigation. I don't know if the police are going to be like, yeah, yeah, nice one, cool. And then just, you know, we've kind of got murders to solve. So fuck off. Do you know what I mean? You know, wow. I don't.
saying that, following on from that, so the guy who's brought it to the police is Lindsay Hoyle. So he's like the MP, he's like a Labour MP in Chorley. And I'd imagine, I don't know how much sway he's got, but I imagine he's got quite a bit, because you'd think he's in charge of at least deciding where some of the funds in that region go. So if he sends a letter directly to the police, the boss of the force is obviously going to have to treat it pretty seriously and get back to him with an acceptable answer. So I could see it actually getting looked into, but I don't know. They're like some little ragtag team of coppers in Chorley. Are they going to take down the worldwide gambling mob? I don't know. The worldwide like dudes behind the boxing. No, I don't think it's going to happen, but I can see it getting looked into seriously, at least this match.
And it should be, surely it's down to the British Boxing Board of Control to sort of like do their very best to clear these allegations that have been pinned against their organization. But if they're so deeply involved in any sort of like bribery, then obviously they're going to be like, ooh, nah, we'll leave it up to the police, isn't it? Because they know that they're not going to be able to dig deep enough under the surface to be able to really, if there is some serious, like, as you say, Jim, insidious things going on, then obviously they're going to try and steer any sort of attention away from it, isn't it? So it's fucking horrible, really.
Well, you know what would be interesting is I was listening to the that boxing podcast, the Boxing Asylum Nuthouse podcast, and they were saying that, you know, Pro Bellum, the new promoter on Sky that replaced Eddie Hearn's Matchroom, who went to the Zone, he's saying they're backed by like Daniel Kinahan, that the head of MTK, isn't it? So like you brought this up last week, Flynn, didn't you? That in terms of, would he have possibly arranged this result for basic financial gain? And I was thinking, like, wouldn't it be mad if the police got involved in boxing because of this fight, and they end up going up the fucking ladder just to get inroads into Daniel Kinahan's criminal organization, man? That'd be pretty fucking crazy. But yeah, I don't know, man. If it's a couple of hot fuzz breaders in Chorley, fuck all's going to happen. But if it's an organization or like Met Police investigation, then something could happen. Fingers crossed it does, to be honest.
All right, number two, over to the MLS. The latest expansion side, Charlotte FC, based in North Carolina, had a league record 74,479 people at their first ever home game last weekend. They watched their side lose 1-0 to LA Galaxy at the Bank of America Stadium, which is also the home to the Carolina Panthers. But what an absolutely monumental sort of moment, really, I think, for the MLS and sort of support for the greatest game on the planet. Do you know what I mean? Is it finally becoming a big thing over here, do you reckon?
Well, it's like you say, they love spending money, don't they? They fucking love it. But 75,000, near enough, that is crazy. So, yeah, does this speak to the quality of the league? Perhaps not. But, like, the popularity of it and the financial viability of it, that's always going to lead to attracting more and more players. A lot of, you know, seasoned veterans from Europe have long time made the MLS their retirement home, basically. So, if... I don't know. Is it a viable place for young players to go and achieve their potential? I'm not sure, but 75,000 in a stadium is a good sign.
Is this team's first game? Are they a new team? And they have 74,000 people there?
Yep. That's new incredible. Franchise team. So I think it's becoming quite a popular thing. There's been a lot of, you know, over the last few years, I think Austin, they become a new team. There was one, is it Tennessee? There's one in Tennessee, I think. So there's been a few franchises over the last 5 years, and I think there's another couple yet to come. So I think they will get up to maybe they'll get up to about 40 teams. Who knows? If they keep on pumping money into it and money keeps burning a hole in American pockets, I think there'll always be room for more sports teams. As we've seen and we spoke about on the five things over the last few weeks, like honestly, any sport Americans will put on TV. So a sport that's as exciting and as much as a reputation as footy does around the globe, I think it's just going to grow, man.
And also Charlotte, North Carolina, the home of Ric Flair. They might be looking for a few new sporting icons after the Nature Boys kind of chilled on the pro wrestling. That's one for you, Bissett.
Was he the woo guy?
Yeah, woo! Limousine riding, jet flying.
See that guy who blanked you in the hotel?
Oh, yeah, that's him, mate. That's him. I never rated him myself, but it's fun. No, he's a fucking legend, man. Absolute legend. But yeah, Charlotte FC, up the boys. If they make their, what's it called? The people that dress, their mascot. They should make their mascot a big bobblehead of Ric Flair, and I'll be a secondary supporter of them for sure.
Done. All right, number three. The Packers and MVP quarterback Aaron Rodgers have agreed to terms on a four-year, $200 million deal that makes him the highest paid player in NFL history. I think this really is a statement of intent from Green Bay. There was a lot of doubt surrounding his future at Lambeau. So this will have put a lot of the cheeseheads at ease. I do still think that my Justin Fields in Chicago is going to be the king of the NFC North this year, though.
200 million?
Yeah.
200 million. The Green Bay Packers aren't even like a sick team, are they?
Yeah, they're pretty consistent. They get to the playoffs most years.
How does that stand against like big news financial deals? Is this up there with like something like the Patriots could do or other profitable teams that I can't think of right now?
Is what it is. Like all teams in the NFL are profitable. That's the way their market works in the NFL. All the teams show profit. And I think it's very different to the way the Premier League teams are ran, where most teams, are in sort of like deficit, really. Do you know what I mean? A lot of the owners pump money in and get no returns historically. So it works a lot different, man. These teams are, the franchise are purely reliant on making money. Do you know what I mean? There's a lot more focus on making money, whereas sort of teams in the Premier League, it's kind of like there's still that kind of like, all right, I'm going to pump money in even though I'm not going to get an immediate return. Some teams make a lot of money. Some teams make a huge loss. So they're always going to be profitable. But there's another big money move. Russell Wilson's gone to Denver as well, which a lot of people are very, very excited about. So they could be a potential sneaky one for the Super Bowl next year.
Would you back him? Would you back Justin Fields just as like in terms of his personal stats? Or would you back the Bears against the Packers overall to finish higher than them?
No, I wouldn't, honestly. If I'm being really, really honest.
You're not even going to lie, man.
I wouldn't touch Chicago Bears with your money, man. So, like, honestly, if you gave me $200 to put on something, I probably wouldn't even put it on Bears, man, to be fair. So, I don't think they got much of a chance. There's another two or three years they need to do rebuilding before they can realistically challenge for a Super Bowl. But number four, and this one's sort of in the world of basketball. So there's this guy called LeBron James, a.k.a. Will Hartzell.
Don't take the piss.
Who has become a viral sensation, who got all his hooping skills from the farm that he lives on. So like this kid, he's racked up like millions of views on social media, doing various workouts and drills, showcasing his skills. And, I was thinking, it got me thinking, can we name any other farm-related basketball players?
No, but I can name you a farm-related UFC fighter, Bryce Mitchell, who beat Edson Barbosa last week. UFC embedded episodes are usually guys training, sparring, just flossing, basically, getting in and out of nice cars and like praising God and all that shit. This guy was walking around his farm, cutting down trees and fucking feeding cows and that. And I was thinking, this guy is going to get this shit kicked out of him. He's like, yeah, I'm just like low level at this farming shit right now. I was like, you don't sound like it, mate. That flannel shirt don't look like it. You look like long term. And he won the fight as well. So I think there's a lot to be said for that farm life, man. I mean, when you've got fuck all to do, fresh air, a lot of space and just, just energy to burn. I think you could get a lot done, man.
Yeah, there was a few praise Jesuses in those post-fight conferences, weren't there, on the weekend? Do you know what I mean?
Oh, they love it, man. There's a lot of like, I think if you're rolling the dice in a cage, you better be thanking someone. And I think a lot of them thank God. Do you know what I mean?
He was pissing me off until at the end, he was like, I'm giving half my purse to, I think it was like children in need or some kind of children's charity. And I was like, man, that's levels, man. To be fair, fair play to him.
Yeah, especially when you're earning fuck all as well.
And there was a contentious decision as well in the UFC. Another Chinese that got done out of a decision, man. I'm sick of it. The wife is sick of it. Do you know what I mean? Zhang Weili, she got done in a match against Rose Namajunas. And then it was a Yan Xiaonan, and a lot of people were very, very upset with that. So, you know, that leads us nicely into our review of the UFC 272, doesn't it?
It does indeed. The Segway King. I'll have to hand over the crown to Bissett, man, because his segues have been absolutely ridiculous these past few weeks. But as you said, UFC 272, headlined by Colby Covington versus Jorge Masvidal. This was a grudge match where the winner would maintain a realistic title aspiration, despite both men having suffered two losses apiece to the welterweight champion, Kamaru Usman. And Leon Edwards still can't get a title shot for love nor money. What the fuck is going on? What's going on?
Were we not talking about Leon last week? I thought you said he was up next. What's happened?
Listen, I don't know what the fuck's going on, man. But he's not scheduled to get a title shot yet. People are more excited about Khamzat, who hasn't even faced a top 10 opponent. Leon Edwards hasn't lost since born, man. Since 1992, undefeated, 500 wins straight, man. He won the Kumite in 95 against Jean-Claude Van Damme. That's what I heard, mate.
He must be shagging Dana White's wife or something. Like, he must be doing some horrible to him because...
He's giving her the length, man. Dana's screwing.
But of course he is. He's one of us, man.
Yeah, he is.
Well,
solidarity with Leon Edwards for his Mrs. Banging proclivities. Yes. So we were talking about it just before the podcast started. And Colby Covington, he emerged a winner by unanimous decision, 50-44, 50-45, and 49-46 on the cards. But he had to overcome some sticky moments to beat his former training partner. The kick to the thigh Masvidal landed in the first round looked like a bruise from a baseball bat in the fifth. And I think those early attacks let Colby know what time it was, because before then, I think he was flirting with the idea of keeping the fight standing just to make an ego point. After that, he made it a point to drive Masvidal to the fence, drag him down, and keep him there with good top position and plenty of ground strikes. Masvidal didn't give an inch, but he was outmatched on the ground, like simple as that. Whenever he did manage to get up, he was a serious threat on the feet. He landed a right hook in the fourth that would have knocked most men cold. Colby's forehead went one way and his jaw went the other. And all that happened is he dropped to one knee and he got straight back up and he was smiling. But he was clearly affected. But when he retreated, Masvidal didn't have the energy to really chase him, having been diminished somewhat by the constant grappling attack of Colby over the previous three rounds. And it wasn't long before Colby dragged him down again. This was a very intelligent game plan from Colby. He was the deserved winner, and Masvidal, as usual, fully accepted that he'd been beaten, even though it must have absolutely fucking killed him. So, respect to both men. I would actually reckon that Colby would get a third crack at the title before Leon does. It's ridiculous, but this was a good win for him. I think he was ranked number two or number one going into this. Masvidal six or seven. He's shown that he belongs in the top tier, and it might just be a fact that he's in the same era as a really dominant champion in Kamaru Usman. Did you watch this one, Bissett? I'm assuming you did.
Yeah, I watched pretty much the whole card. I really don't like the guy. I really wanted Masvidal to do him in. I just don't like him. There's something about him. I don't like his arrogance, man. I don't really like the way he fights. So I was hoping that Masvidal was going to absolutely do him, but he just really got neutralized by Colby. I think he did come in with a sort of a relatively intelligent game plan. I just don't think Masvidal could really match him in the wrestling game. I was very surprised that when Masvidal did land that right hook in the fourth, that he didn't sort of like unload the clip on him and he didn't really try and finish it there and then. But I think we spoke about this and we was talking about how exhausted he was from all those takedown defenses up against the cage. So I think that really, it did deplete his energy resources. I mean, he just didn't have enough in him to follow up. But fair play to Colby, man. He can fucking take a hit as well, can't he?
Yeah, that was a ridiculous shot that he swallowed. And it's funny that you mention his personality, because I've got a theory about Colby Covington. He puts on this persona of I'm the fucking MAGA hat wearing, absolute cringeworthy, like false pro wrestling promo type guy. But then he repeatedly allows himself to get caught on film just being sound to people, just admitting that it's a fake persona. So I've got a real feeling this is a man who wants to be popular, who wants to be loved, but he's playing this over-the-top persona just to play the game, like Chael Sonnen. Maybe not like Conor McGregor. I think he's gone west. But, like, you know, like other big villainous personalities. That's my theory. I think he's like a sound guy.
I think you're right there. I remember reading about him that he was on the chopping block at one point. I think Uncle Dana called him, told him he was getting the sack. Next fight he has, it's in Brazil. After the fight, he calls all the Brazilians dogs, and then he starts wearing his MAGA hat, starts hitting the headlines again. Boom. He's got the job still. It's clearly a persona he's playing. He's a heel in wrestling, basically. That's what it is.
Well, it's interesting that he allows himself to get caught out of character so many times. Like, he knows when people are filming him. He knows when there's a camera on in the gym. He knows if someone's filming him talking to a fan and he's just giving him sound advice. That's him telling you, like, this is really me. And then still acting like a dickhead 80% of the time. It's an interesting, like, paradox, really, that he's carrying out. And it helps that he's, like, a world-level fighter as well.
So, and what do you reckon to the way the fight was built? Was it was, like, these best friends turned enemies kind of thing. And it did feel like there was, like, that animosity, like, throughout the fight in the cage. After every round, there was a little spat. There was a little glare with each other. And obviously, Masvidal was sort of magnanimous in defeat, really. But to be honest, you could tell that he was sort of like really hurting and he really badly wanted to beat him. But then you're saying that, you know, maybe he isn't this sort of like terrible guy outside the ring. They were very, very close at one stage. And I'm not sure if there's been nothing publicly that would suggest to me why they fell out so badly. It seems to be mainly down to the fact that Colby thinks that Masvidal is jealous of Covington's sort of like rise up the ranks and his success. But that doesn't buy me as having enough weight for them to have like actual sort of hatred to each other. So what do you think's gone on there?
We're going to call bullshit on this feud. This is a Vince McMahon playbook, isn't it?
I called it last week. I thought it was bullshit. But at the same time, after the fight, they were still jawing at each other. And one of Colby's team was giving it the big one as well to Masvidal, going like, you had five rounds, motherfucker. Why are you still talking? Listen, it's hard for me to imagine. Well, I'll tell you what, I'll stop that thought before I even started, because Masvidal, I think part of his motivation for fighting is to take things personally and to really invigorate his energy with hatred, really, to sharpen his skills. The way other fighters use fear, he wants to fuck you up, innit? That seems to be where his mentality is. Whereas Colby seems to feed off all the shit he's been talking. A lot of personalities would crumble under that pressure, whereas it seems to invigorate him on that level. I'm not sure if anything real happened. I was calling bullshit before. I wouldn't be surprised if it was a Vince McMahon playbook, man. Mick Foley special. Stone Cold Steve Austin. Do you know what I mean? I wouldn't be surprised at all, because at the end of the day, if Colby Covington's career has taught us anything, it's the value of controversy and the value of drama. And to do it that blatantly and for everyone to still buy into it, that just fucking shows you, doesn't it? Everyone loves a grudge match, and that's probably what that was.
And that's what they were saying, man. Like, you know, all the commentary team was saying, oh, one of the biggest grudge matches the UFC has ever seen. I was like, Khabib McGregor was more of a grudge match than that, by far.
Definitely.
So, I mean,
that was real.
Khabib actually genuinely hated him on like levels, like, because he was like offending him. Do you know what I mean? He was actually offending him, everything down to his fabric as a human being, man. So I think that had like, so far away in terms of a grudge match to that. So I think that was they're just using that as a sort of tool to try and promote fights, and it, which is kind of like, is what it is, isn't it?
I mean, even John Jones, Daniel Cormier, man. You ever seen the footage of them when they're doing their promotions for the fight, and the cameras aren't supposed to be running, but they are running, and this is when John Jones is like still putting out the image, the persona that he's a nice guy. And he's talking to Cormier in his earpiece. And he's going, you're still there, pussy. Daniel Cormier is like, you're a fucking, you're a fake piece of shit. He's like, fuck you. And John Jones is like, I would fucking kill you if this was a street fight. And Daniel Cormier says, you think I'm just going to let you come and fucking kill me, man? He's like, fuck you. I'd spit on you if you were right here. It's wicked, man. Like, that is actual, that weren't supposed to hit the airwaves. Do you know what I mean? And to sit, and then they got in a fist fight at a press conference, and then all that mad shit. That's some real shit. I didn't get that same type of vibe from Colby and from Masvidal. But We'll move on to the one boxing fight I want to cover from last week. And it's a masterpiece from the 35, well, he's 35 next month, I think. 34-year-old, super flyweight, Chocolatito Gonzalez. And last week, I carried on a fine ball chat tradition by picking Julio Cesar Martinez to win the fight. But it was clear from the first round, I made a drastic miscalculation. Martinez's youth, his appetite for battle, his chin, his unorthodox punching style, it counted for absolutely nothing. Chocolatito was like a tutorial video on how to box. The distance management, his reading of Martinez, his punch variety, how relaxed he was, how he upped and dropped the pace whenever he needed to, the accuracy. I mean, halfway through, I was beginning to worry about Martinez, seriously. He was too tough for his own good, and he was taking far too many clean punches. His corner should have pulled him out because that tough little fucker was going nowhere. A punch from Chocolatito would make him look at the ceiling and drive him back to the ropes, and he'd just bang his gloves together and wave Chocolatito in. It was sadistic, to be honest with you. And rounds 10, 11, and 12, I think they were like life changers, really. But on the other side, in terms of Chocolatito's performance, I can't say enough good things about it. He's got 3 defeats on his record, 2 of them to the same man. How do you say his name? Sinsraket Sorungvisai from Thailand. He lost a close decision in the first fight. Got absolutely smashed in the second. I think he got knocked out in the fourth round, knocked out cold as well. He was set to rematch Juan Francisco Estrada from the split decision loss last year before Estrada got COVID and Martinez was a late replacement for this. I hope they can make that rematch down the line. But Chocolatito, last Saturday, he showed what an immense fighter he still is. And he could live, he could thrive in any era. I can't wait to see him again, man. And I look ahead to this week's fights. We've got Lee Wood defending his WBA featherweight title against Michael Conlon in Nottingham, which is Lee Wood's hometown. Wood overturned the heavy favourite Kan Ju to win the belt last July under Ben Davidson, the British Boxing Border Control's Trainer of the Year, despite his recent showing with Josh Taylor. Wood's world title win came just 2 fights after a majority decision loss against Jazza Dickens. While Michael Conlon looks to fulfil the promise that has surrounded his career since his Olympic dream ended in 2016 with yet another robbery on the cards in Brazil. Boxing fans will remember his middle finger protest to that. He's a bit of a legend. But only Jason Cunningham stands out on his record as a good, solid name. And I was actually at that fight in Manchester in 2018. So we're going to see on Saturday if he's the goods or not. Later this week in MMA, ONE Championship, their main event, I think that's tomorrow night, Jiu-Jitsu Lord Gary Tonon challenges Than Lee for the featherweight title. And Bibiano Fernandez defends his bantamweight belt against John Lineker. That one was rescheduled from a few weeks ago. Thiago Santos and Magomed Ankalaev headline the UFC's Fight Night card. And Adam Borix versus Mads Burnell, top of the bill for Bellator 276. Both of those on Saturday. It's a big week for the fights. I'm quite looking forward to Conlon versus Wood. It's been a bit needly on the build-up, and we talked about the kind of fake animosity between Covington and Masvidal. And I think this the needle's legitimate between these two. I think like Michael Conlon, his brother Jamie, very exciting European level fighter. They're just giving it loads. Like, you know, Irish people are like absolutely up for the row, just taking the piss, like undermining them every chance they get. Pretty much putting their balls on the line and saying that Michael Conlon is the man that he promised to be before his Olympic dream ended.
In disgusting fashion as well. Like, I remember watching the... I had to go back and watch that recently because I watched a clip of him, and I think his trainer spoke afterwards, and they were just like, fucking disgusting. And when I went back and watched it, and I was like, fucking hell, yeah, that was bad. Definitely backhanders going on there. No!
Oh, no. Oh, there's no corruption in boxing. No. I know for a fact there's no corruption in boxing. Fucking crooks, man, a lot of them. So... Yeah, listen, Michael Conlon has had a very underwhelming pro career. I don't see him beating Lee Wood in this fight at all. I don't see it. I mean, hopefully it's like a mad war. I hope Michael Conlon takes a leaf out of his brother Jamie's book and absolutely just goes for it. But I don't see it, man. I think Wood's going to pick him apart.
Is this the hot take?
This is the hot take. Bet your house on, obviously. Like. But yeah, now I'm looking forward to it, man, because Lee Wood, underdog title winner himself, Conlon, the guy waiting to fulfill his potential, Adam Booth versus Ben Davison. I'm actually going to be in Edinburgh the night of this fight, so I'm not sure if I'm going to catch it live. Probably catch it on the Sunday morning, unless it's in like the bar that we're at. So yeah, that's it for the fights this week.
Yeah, that's pretty much all we've got time for then this week, lads. So once again, a pleasure as always.
Cheers.
Nice one, boys. A pleasure. We'll catch you next week.